And our special guest tonight, Clifford Carnicom, we're talking about aerosol sprays up in the air. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Cliff, let's go through these seven that you had pointed out to us. We'll digest each one here. It'll probably take us the entire hour, but they'll be well worth it. Environmental matters here. Modification, perhaps weather manipulation as well.
Sure, George. Thank you. We talked about contrails and how they're physically composed, and we talked about clouds and what are the requirements for clouds to form. If you now introduce a third entity, that of the aerosol, it changes the dynamics of what's happening in a big way in the sky. Remember that contrails require nothing except for moisture, basically, to freeze in a cold environment. Clouds require moisture and particles. Now, what if you were to introduce an extremely small particle, which is what they need to be for clouds, What if you were to introduce a very small particle, and that particle had the ability and capacity to absorb moisture at very low humidity levels? What would happen?
If you would do that at very low humidity levels?
Absolutely. The operations are conducted essentially at flight altitude, roughly, 35 to 40,000 feet. There's people will say exceptions, but generally, high altitude in terms of aviation traffic is taking place. And the moisture at that level is generally quite low. This is why contrails form fine there.
Okay.
You do not need much moisture up there. But if you were to introduce a salt that can absorb moisture at very low levels, and there are some, and strontium chloride is the one that I have documented that will absorb moisture at roughly 30% humidity, okay? This changes everything because where clouds require moisture levels of roughly humidity levels of roughly 70% or greater to form, if you introduce a water-loving nuclei or small particle in a low moisture environment, it can create a phenomenon which we are now confusing as this grand mix that there's really no difference anymore between contrails and clouds. We create these things that we don't really know what they are, but we start conveniently calling them clouds, even though they're developing at the level of where cirrus clouds form, which are thin, wispy clouds. But suddenly we have an entire layer across the sky at 35,000 feet. You're changing the physics of the atmosphere in a way that is creating a new entity.
Maybe that's why it's so turbulent up there when we're in a plane.
Well, another thing, in terms of environmental modification and control, what happens then? Okay. You are affecting the moisture levels in a big way. You're attracting moisture, and essentially you're locking up the moisture in the atmosphere. And my conclusion, one conclusion would be that this is a quite feasible means of harnessing the energy of storm systems. I've done quite a bit of work to try and determine when these operations are actually taking place. And there's an interesting body of work involving ionization and humidity. But if you look at that work, The conclusion is reached that the most likely times that the operations are occurring in any given area are moments or periods of what you would call local, low relative humidity. And the word local is real important because it means relative to what was happening before and after. It doesn't mean local in a low in an absolute
right
necessarily, okay? And it's quite an interesting phenomenon, but down literally to the period of a matter of a few hours, over and over and over. I did this study for roughly a month and a half, measured ionization levels and humidity levels, and looked at that data very carefully. And this is a pattern that is emerging from that it's a very strategic time in which they are coming in. And it's not, as people claim, during periods of high humidity. If you look at the counterargument here, they'll say, hey, this is just normal and fine as could be. These things are going to happen when your humidity is high. These operations are not taking place when the humidity is high. They are taking place most often, what I see, immediately before and prior to entering humidity.
All right, then I assume they also then create rain with these false clouds. What's the purpose?
Well,
why would they do that?
I believe it's destroying the rain, George. It locks up that moisture.
All right.
It does not. We are losing our rainfall from this.
Okay. Okay.
You are locking up this moisture, and I believe harnessing the energy of that storm to use in other ways, which is where we get into the electromagnetic aspects, because these materials as I mentioned, have the ability to be ionized or become charged through sunlight. And you start to change the dynamics of everything going on there. But sticking to the issue of environmental modification, one is that you expect the moisture patterns of the planet to be dramatically altered. And in general, you expect the moisture to be diminished. This is what you would expect. The second thing is that these materials, they're heating up the air. You know, there's a lot of airtime and press which has been given to the notion that these materials are somehow in there for our good, even though we're not supposed to know about them. They're somehow for our good, and it's some benevolent program to inhibit or mitigate global warming. The evidence does not support that thesis at all. From what I see, these materials are heating up. It's based on heat, specific heat of a material. These materials are being dispersed into the lower atmosphere. A lot of folks are citing a report by Teller saying that, hey, he laid this whole thing out, and then this is what you do. You dump this stuff in the air. If you look at Teller's report, he did not say putting this stuff in the lower atmosphere. He said at the very least, the lowest place you would put this stuff would be in the stratosphere, 18 miles above, not 67 miles above the Earth. He says that the stratosphere is not a favorable location to be doing this, and where you really want to be doing is out in low orbit, roughly 150 miles away above the Earth, or 400,000 miles. The guy is talking about putting this stuff in space because it heats up, and you want to draw the heat away from the Earth. You don't put this material into the lower atmosphere as it is and expect it to be curing global warming. As a matter of fact, the evidence says it is as exacerbating and aggravating global warming, if not a significant constituent and component of the global warming.
Could it be causing droughts in the region?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's actually expected to be causing droughts. If you put a desiccating material into the upper atmosphere that draws that water and holds it in and becomes basically an electrically conductive environment, you're playing with your weather in a very big way. You expect the moisture patterns, you expect the heat patterns, and you expect the wind patterns to be dramatically altered as a result of introducing this material, hence the likely agenda, one of many, but the likely agenda of environmental modification and control, but not for the purpose of mitigating global warming by any sensible interpretation of the data that I can see, but in fact aggravating and exacerbating the problem, if not directly contributing to it.
Fascinating. Biological. What are they doing there?
All right. If you look at these samples, it started with those filaments that we spoke of. If you look at these samples, you start to see a very unusual entity exist in those samples. Over and anytime I do something, it's not once. It's usually not one time. It has to be repeated.
All right.
Okay? You had these filaments come in. There was a medical professional in this area that was looking at these materials at the same time I was. I did not know that at the time. I was putting my work under the microscope, offering what I could. I started out with a $30 toy microscope when I first did my work, offered what I could to people. I had an individual contact me and said, Clifford, I'm seeing some things you can't see. Come down here and take a look. This individual had some of these similar filaments, if not identical filaments, that I had in my sample. And in fact, his purpose for having me there was to have a second independent sample because he wanted to see if what was happening in his sample was happening in an independent sample. Because what he was seeing was some, let's say, quite sophisticated and advanced microscope equipment. He was seeing biological components. Now, I'm going to say this outright because it's what he said. This was not my conclusion. This was his conclusion at the time. He said, my identification of this material is as a red blood cell. Now, that sort of blew my mind at that point, okay, because now you know if that's true, you're dealing with something really heavy here.
Absolutely.
All right? Because this is far beyond what anyone would expect. Now, at that point, I don't try to pass judgment right away. I try to get the data, and all I'm saying is this is what the person told me. We spent time under the microscope. What he needed was my sample to see if it had the same elements, components within it. The fact is it did, and that's what he was after, to find out if this was unique, a one of a kind, or it could be corroborated with another sample. While I was there, I noticed something under the microscope that he had not seen that was even sort of more unusual, and that was a cluster development. Those photographs and all that work is posted on the site. The fact is that at that point, there was an initial discovery that said, we're dealing apparently not with just with unusual fibers, but it looks like we may be dealing with a biological aspect to these materials as an added component. My work probably went on for 2 years after that, I would guess, before I got some better microscope equipment and did more detailed work. My work is, you know, continued to evolve with limited resources. And I started doing some work which showed components also. And I'll make this short. It's a result of probably two dozen episodes under the scope, each involving hours and hours and hours of work. But the work indicates the presence of erythrocytes on a repeated basis. Erythrocyte is a red blood cell. Now, what's different here, and this even goes back to the original sample, what's different and what made the work difficult and unusual for even this original person was that these components appear to be desiccated, meaning dried. His term that he used at the time was freeze-dried. They appear to be
freeze-dried blood cells.
Yes. The work that I have done indicates, I'm not a doctor. I don't claim to be a doctor. I put up my work and I say, this is what I see, folks. These are my photographs. These are my methods. What do we have here? I did it over and over and over. And if you look at my work, I will say, to the best that I can determine, visual identification, I'm real good at measurement, so I can measure size of things real well. The properties of the materials that I have identified satisfy the properties of a desiccated erythrocyte that can be reconstituted under a certain circumstance.
What does that do, Cliff, to you?
What does what do?
The red cells, if you inhale it.
I have no idea. This is an observation. These things, we should all be asking that, George.
Sure.
We should all be asking that question, right? And not only that, we shouldn't be asking them, we should be getting the answers. My resources are limited. Most of my work is based on my academic background with limited resources. It is obvious that significant and sufficient resources should have been and should be devoted to the direct answer to these questions. In my work, continually from the beginning, you see nothing but an appeal to say, this is what I find. Is this for real? Will somebody do this work and find out what the heck we're dealing with? It's across the board. There is a clear pattern of the work never being done, or let's say almost never being done. I certainly mentioned Staniger's work, and there may be some work being done quietly, but this is for the public. This is not something to be held in secret for a few to know. The public is being affected. The public deserves to know. You have serious environmental, health, medical, biological issues that are surrounding us in our environment that we deserve and need to know.
Incredible work, though, Cliff, I got to tell you.
I thank you. I'm not alone. There are others. I just happen to be a person who let's say, presents my work to the public.
Okay, military, which was your third aspect, also, though, could be tied into all of them.
Well, yes, what happens, George, you know, as you look at these issues, the more that you study them, the more that you see a likely complex web of interacting and interwoven agendas. This is what appears to be most reasonable. And it's very difficult to draw some line and say, well, this is where it ends and it can't go into that domain. What happens when you start talking about military operations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, does the military have an interest in conducting covert biological operations? Does the military have an interest in controlling weather for warfare? Of course they do. And so it is expected and really quite normal in a sense that you expect a military aspect to that. What is our indication that that's the case? One of them certainly has to be indirect, and that is if you look at who has shown an interest in my research at a point when I had no public notoriety at all. When I started on my website, I was a very quiet person, still am quiet by nature, but I was putting my material up in a public way. Nobody knew who I was. Who was it that was coming to look at my work? The military was all over that site. in very serious ways. There is a list there. I stopped that a long time ago because a point was made. But there is a list that was accumulated over the first few months of work. They've now put things behind firewalls where no such things are impossible to do. But at a time, at that time, you could tell to a degree where visitors were coming from. There is a major effort presence by the deepest aspects of the military in this country, apparently to monitor the progress of that research. You also have eventually a response by the United States Air Force when confronted with this issue, and their public declaration is that the entire issue that we are speaking of tonight is a hoax, that this is a hoax that has no reality. This is the Air Force official position. They say that that is corroborated by all of the basic significant media and academic institutions of this country. In doing so, they do not cite those media organizations, nor do they cite those academic institutions in their statement. But they do declare it as a hoax. Now, a rather interesting revelation that occurred some years later, this is probably about 2 years later, but if you look into the individual that was chosen to make that edict and pronouncement to the public that this was a hoax, that not deserving of consideration, and certainly not involving the military in any way, you will find that that individual is a Colonel Gibson. Colonel Gibson. And if you furthermore look into Colonel Gibson's job performance, you will see that he is a master intelligence officer. That is his job in the military, is to manage intelligence information at a extremely high level.
All right, Electra, we have in Alaska HAARP, that project that they're beaming for some reason. Could these aerosol sprays be tied into that at all?
Yes, they could, and they are expected to, actually. If we now go back and we examine that a little bit deeper, we talked about, you know, putting a submicron water-loving particulate into the atmosphere, right? And we mentioned that these materials, a certain class of materials, have the property that they can ionize with the energy of sunlight. That's pretty profound, really. You can't do that with just anything. These are rather unique. To think that you could expose something to sunlight. Somebody made a joke out of this one day, and they said, you put table salt out on the patio, and it's going to ionize. They were making a joke, but the truth is it actually happens. If you look at magnesium salts from the ocean, and you actually get a mist that forms over them, there is an ionization that is taking place of those magnesium salts in the ocean. So it's straight physics, but you can look at the ionization energy that's required, and certain elements will satisfy this property. Barium is certainly one of these, barium, calcium, magnesium. But barium is certainly the ideal candidate here. And the physical tests indicate the presence of barium over and over and over. That's really my most positive confirmation that I have made and put the most time into because of the remarkable properties of that element. Now, what does it mean if you ionize something? It means it becomes electrically charged. Okay? When you're talking about a gas, the atmosphere is a gas,
all right,
and that gas can become electrically charged, it becomes what is known as a plasma. And I didn't know anything about plasma when I started this, okay? I go where the research goes. And this is where the work leads. If you ionize a material and it's in a gas, you're creating the components of what a plasma is.
And you can aim that, can't you?
The energy within that, I guess the first thing to acknowledge is that you now have created an electrically conductive medium.
Let's pick that up when we come right back, Cliff. And next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Clifford Carnicom. And also we'll open up the lines if there are any whistleblowers here who might have some more inside information for us about aerosols. He calls it aerosol crimes. Clifford, you were wrapping up your thoughts on the electro portion of these aerosols before we move into some of the other areas.
Yes, George, thank you very much. And
sure.
In some ways here, we're tying together, number 3 and 4 on this list of electromagnetic and military. But to follow through on this plasma idea just a little bit further, first is that the definition of a plasma is that of an electrically conductive gas. The most familiar common example that most of us would know about that demonstrates what a plasma is about would be a neon light tube. That's exactly what it is.
Okay.
There is no bulb in that tube, but you have filled it with a gas that is basically an ionized gas. And if you send energy through that tube, what happens in that case? You get light. Okay. So you get a dramatic physical effect because of the introduction of, in many cases, a relatively small amount of electrical charge. Another example that we could use to bring things to closer to home to would be the ionosphere. Many of us are familiar with what's called the ionosphere. This is a layer roughly 60 miles above us. The actual charge on that, it's very small. In other words, a very small change in the electrical charge of a gas can have dramatic physical manifestations. And the atmosphere, the ionosphere in the upper atmosphere is one of those examples and completely, revolutionized communication, allowed for the propagation of radio. It's a huge physical deal.
So do you think this is a communication tool?
Well, that could be only one. Basically, it opens it up. If you have an electrically conductive environment, it opens it up to the proposition of sending energy of some form, electromagnetic energy, from point A to point B. That's what it opens up. And it opens it up in a much more general way than just communication. Energy can be manifested certainly with weapon systems. Take the time, if somebody's interested in it, take the time to read the patent for by Bernard Eastland, which many regard as the blueprint for the HARP project. When I started reading that, a fair amount of it was slightly Greek, let's say.
Sure.
But I took my time with it. And if you look at the premises within that patent, they are matched as close as you can possibly imagine to just about everything we're talking about tonight. And you will see the Eastland patent talking about the introduction of barium into the atmosphere. You will see them talking about increasing the electron density, meaning the charge of the environment. You will see them talking about directing energy from point A to point B. You will see them talking about military operations across the board, one small one of which would be communication. A much more grand one would be look into what they're, when he's talking about what's called a heave weapon. This is amazing, but it's actually possible. This is conceptual at this point. This is what a patent is about. But the guy is talking about building up energy in this plasma state to the state that it could literally lift up the magnetic field of the Earth. They call it a heave weapon. And this thing is so grand that it's basically it's the same magnitude as an atomic bomb, a nuclear bomb. But there is no bomb, okay? It lifts the magnetic field of the Earth up. It's a tremendous amount of energy. And it can be used in an incredibly destructive manner. This is what's on the guy's mind. And it means that it makes sense from a physical standpoint for the patent to have existed. And many of us have good reason to believe that the technology invested in HARP is exploring, if not capable, of manifesting these technologies.
Sounds like they're grabbing a little bit of Tesla technology here, Cliff.
It very much does. Tesla is written in this all over the place. So if somebody wants an education, take some time with that Eastland patent and look at the parallels. They're just across the board. Now, one other comment on this, the electromagnetic work. It was a lot of work again. It was similar to a biological work. It was many, many sessions over a prolonged period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time when a major body of the work was done, and then I let it sit. A lot of times I'll let it sit, and then I'll come back, and sometimes it's a year or two later, and I say, is that still happening?
Mm-hmm.
Is this so deep and so broad that this is still happening? This is what happened on the biological side. It was difficult and unfortunate to accept that this appears to be a resident situation. The same thing happened with the measurement and detection of what I would call ambient ELF energy. I developed equipment and built circuits and this kind of thing to ask the question of whether or not one could detect the presence of ELF energy in our environment. Now, what is ELF? ELF is extremely low frequency waves, extremely low frequency with corresponding wavelength. These are wavelengths that are operating in the range of roughly 0 to 100 hertz. Now, let's see, your light system in your home, your AC system runs at 60 hertz. So, but here's what's important in this case. Your brain works at roughly, call it 4 to 12 hertz. Okay? This is where human biology functions, is in the ELF range. And this is why when some of the initial work on antenna systems up in Wisconsin, they had one built for submarine communication. They need to send these waves long distances. When you have a very low wavelength,
good point.
Low frequency, you get a very long wavelength. So they use that to communicate with submarines. And a lot of people got riled up in Wisconsin when they started building that antenna because you're generating frequencies that correspond with the functioning of human biology. And so there was a lot of concern about that at that time. Now, my work was asking the question, is there resident or ambient ELF energy around us? It's a very difficult thing to detect. It's not real easy because you're usually dealing with antennas that are really long, like the Navy would have. But I did this work, and I did it over and over, did a lot of experimentation. The result says the answer is yes. And it's not a question of once. It's not a question of twice. It's over and over. All the papers are there if somebody wants to see it. And the conclusion is that there appears to be resident or ambient ELF energy with, in my work, in a case, the conclusion is there's a fundamental frequency of 4 hertz. In other words, the lowest frequency that I find appears to be 4 hertz, and then multiples of it are found. So 4 hertz, 8 hertz, 12 hertz, 16 hertz. And the problem is that if this is true, it's saying it's around us all the time. It's clearly artificial in terms of when you look at the data, you see these steps. It's step data. There's no natural explanation that I can find for this. The Schumann resonance, if people wanting to get into that, is 8 hertz. You don't have something at 4 hertz that I know, because the wavelength would be basically twice the circumference of the Earth.
Could it hurt us?
Yes, it could hurt us.
All these things could hurt us.
Yes, they could. I'm sorry to say they could. ELF energy operates at the same level as our brain. Therefore, it is quite conceivable that systems could be developed that could, let's say, interfere, affect, influence, or manipulate functioning of the human mind. It appears quite feasible that that's the case. Again, it would not be unexpected. And again, there is an adequate basis for an answer to this question. But the evidence says that it is there. And you know, it was a little bothersome to me that time because I waited like a year and a half, and I go, maybe things have changed.
Let's get into number 5, Cliff, and then 6 and 7, I never even anticipated, so we'll get into that too. But geophysical, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, this one is a bit more conceptual, but it had to do, and it has to do, with considering the amount of energy that we're talking about. What is it that's really possible here? And you remember when I was talking to you about the heave weapon, okay? It's H-E-A-V-E.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't imagine that when I started, but you're actually talking about a system that builds up enough energy to lift up the magnetic field of the Earth. This is a geophysical planetary thing, if this is for real, if you can do it, okay? So the question is, what kind of energy levels are we dealing with here? And so I got into quite a bit of work there for a while to examine the question as to whether or not the energy that could be accumulated in this plasma state, if you accept my thesis that the conditions have been created for a plasma state in the lower atmosphere as opposed to the upper atmosphere, such as the ionosphere, then what kind of energy is possible to accumulate in that shell? And it was really quite interesting. Again, it's more conceptual. I have nothing direct. We're talking about Earth effects here. But the work led to the conclusion that it actually does appear as though it would be possible. It appears conceivable to me that you could accumulate enough energy in this plasma. And by the way, you do that by introducing ELF. If you dig up the equation for the thing, which is not all easy to find, not a lot easy to find for, you know, common folk to dig into this stuff. But if you get into plasma physics and you find the equations that govern the accumulation of energy in a plasma state, you will find that that equation is affected by the frequency. You're introducing energy into it. And you're asking, you know, the resonance thing. You know when you're talking about Tesla?
Yes.
That's the idea, okay? You in a resonant way, you attempt to accumulate energy, and you'll find that that equation is dependent upon the frequency. And the lower the frequency that you introduce into it, the more energy that you can accumulate. So it becomes, of course, very interesting that we appear to have the discovery of a frequency much lower, you know, than even the Schumann resonance, which is an earthly thing. It's based upon the physical dimensions of the Earth. That if you put the numbers, you know, you work out the math of this stuff, the numbers come out that it actually appears it's conceivable to me, if you introduce that low enough frequency in there, that you could actually accumulate enough energy where you're talking about literally geophysical and planetary operations. More specifically, the Earth is slowing down very slightly, very slowly. But if you look into the astronomy business, you'll find that the Earth is slowing down very, very slowly.
Well, you've done your homework. Surveillance, what do you mean by this one?
Okay, and my conclusion there, George, was that the energy we're talking about appears to be on par with the change, not the actual amount, but the change in energy of the rotation of the Earth. And if you further, if you look at the graphs of time, like they have the introduction of leap years, you'll find this very sharp discontinuity in the introduction of the leap years, which is time is a function of the rotation of the Earth. You'll find a very sharp discontinuity at the time that these operations started at the grand scale. So that's where that work. The surveillance, as we go along in these later categories, they become more conceptual because we don't have the physical resources, or I don't, to actually test them. I can only come up with a conceptual basis. But the surveillance one, I have not written this up on the site. The last two have not been written up, and they've come as afterthoughts in the work. But most of us are familiar with radar. And radar is when you send out a radio wave to an object, and it bounces back. Excuse me.
Sure.
And you detect this object, right?
Yep.
Okay. Well, radar, for it to work, the object has to be of a certain size. And it actually has to be a bit big. This is why ships and planes and this type of stuff works with radar. And it has to do with the wavelength of the object that you're detecting is on par with the wavelength of the medium that you're using to detect it, namely radio waves. Okay? Radar is an extension of the radio frequency range. And there is a match between the wavelengths of the radar that is used, radio frequency waves, higher end of it, or at least the end of the range, and the object you're detecting. Now, take that principle and investigate a phenomenon known as LIDAR instead of radar. And LIDAR is where you use light waves to detect an object as opposed to radio waves.
So it's basically also for heavy security for us.
It appears, again, this is conceptual,
if
but
that's
it's based on sound reasoning. The wavelengths that are tied in with light waves are extremely small, and they are on par with the size of the materials that we're talking about that have been introduced into the atmosphere. So it's quite conceivable to me that you can have a surveillance system based not on detecting a ship or a plane, but on detecting basically microscopic particulate matter. That opens up many interesting possibilities about, you know, individual identity, object detecting, you know, you're talking down to the cellular level possibly, right? It gets pretty deep in terms of the level of surveillance that could become possible there. Now, another reason this caught my interest, I can't really remember which came first here, but I came across a paper And it was written by, I believe their name is the American Federation of Scientists. This is my best recollection. We can correct me if I'm wrong.
All right.
But this group, what they are is they're basically the think tank of the Manhattan Project. These were the folks that were behind the atomic bomb. And there is a legacy of those people. And they are in a group called what I believe is the American Federation of Scientists. Heavy duty thinkers of technology and how it affects military systems and this type of thing. I came across a paper by these folks, and they were talking about nuclear weapons, and they were basically saying, well, you know, we've made some mistakes there. It doesn't look like it's so good for humanity. And then they were outlining what they thought was the most significant project in the future to develop. And you know what it was?
What?
It was a surveillance system based upon LIDAR.
Huh. Well, you may be onto something there, too.
So my argument is conceptual, based upon in addition to the published ideas of some folks that think in grand ways of developing systems that affect nations warfare and security and this type of thing. And it appears to be quite feasible to me that such a development could exist from that.
Another fascinating one, of course, the last one is the possibility that this is some kind of offshoot of some propulsion system up there.
Yeah, what it is, this is sort of, again, it's conceptual, but the generic term is going to be UFO. The technical term I will use will be detection of exotic or unusual propulsion systems. In the common language, that would be detection of a UFO. What it means is that if we accept that the ionic and electrical qualities of the atmosphere have been changed, and if you were to have a propulsion system that either uses that charge or influences or affects that charge, which I believe most systems would, any type of advanced propulsion system, I believe would likely be involved with ionic exchanges of some type and or magnetic. It's quite feasible to me that if you have a system that could detect disturbances within that plasma state, that would be a very beneficial thing to be able to do. And to me, the principles are in place for that to happen. Again, I have no measurement, no detection. This is just more of a analytical conceptual examination of the problem. And it says to me it would be quite feasible that you could want to, if not develop a system that would be able to detect disturbances within that environment besides the creation of the environment itself.
We talked earlier about whether these sprays are done during the daytime or nighttime. Why don't they hide it? Why don't they do it at night?
Well, this is the grand idea of, you know, put something right in front of their face if you want to hide it.
Yeah.
We're at this state in the world now where I think it's difficult for people to distinguish reality from fiction.
They must cringe then when they hear programs like this.
I would hope so, at least.
Yeah.
I would hope so. But, you know, this is out there. This is right in your face. But many of us are now accepting of the fact that we are being lied to on a regular and continual basis about very significant events in our world. And many of us are on our own or with our peers to try to make sense of this reality that we are now in. And this issue is certainly representative of those conflicts. All I can say is 7 years of research, not just by myself. I am one contributor, but the evidence is there for those that wish to examine it. This issue has demonstrated a remarkable capacity of people to deny a phenomenon which exists in their very face if they would choose to look at it.
Cliff, stay with us. We'll be back with phone calls, whistleblowers. And you can also tell us about this Twilight Zone project, what that means. We'll be back.